The theme of the lecture this afternoon is Utopia or Oblivion? Utopia or Oblivion? We'll pick up the questions that should have been left by the lecture yesterday at the end of the crisis of humanism. Where do we go in the future? But let me begin by giving you a series of quotations which will set the stage for the lecture this afternoon. First, from Kenneth Clark, the English author of a television series on civilization. Confident articles in the future seem to me intellectually the most disreputable of all forms of public utterance. Timothy Leary just lives up the hill from us. Trust the evolutionary process. It's all going to work out all right. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, the French priest. Everything that formerly made for war now makes for peace. Gordon Rantry Taylor, the English science writer. The current indications are that the world is bent on going to hell in a handcart, and that's probably what it will do. Joan Byers. You are the orphans in an age of no tomorrow. Norman O'Brown. Today, even the survival of humanity is utopian hope. Bob Dylan from Desolation Row. The Titanic sails at dawn. To prophesy is extremely difficult, especially with respect to the future. That's a Chinese proverb, and the exquisite irony of it is tremendous. But that should be counterbalanced for us by the urgency of the question itself. What does the future really hold for modern man and for modern society? Futurology is a fascinating, exploding new study, sometimes called the Foresight Saga, punning on the other series, or a series of guesstimates. But what's true is that it's no longer the preserve of dreamers and visionaries and poets and science fiction writers, but now futurology is the sincerest concern of government departments, scenario scientists, and think tanks. Soon, a chair of futurology will probably be in every major university, and it's certainly going to become a new academic industry. All major speeches today have a habit of including the ritual reference to the challenge of change. And these are all aspects of the fact that futurology is just exploding on us as the big new interest. But obviously this question is not just of academic significance. All the tangled threads of our present problems trail into the future. And it appears that the future alone holds the key, if there is one, to the problems of where we are today. But now what's the importance of futurology? We can't understand the rise of futurology apart from seeing the end of ideology. A lot of people in the 50s began to speak of the end of ideology, the fact that all traditional ideologies were bankrupt. But what happened was, when they talked about the end of ideology, they actually elevated a new ideology, which was futurology, tending to bank all their hopes in the world of the future. There are several reasons why it's important. I'll just mention three. First of all, it's often the Achilles heel of many people's point of view or worldview or philosophy on which they bank their hopes. It's often the testing ground for many current views of life. It's often as you see a man's view of himself in the future that you discover the weak point of an otherwise impregnable opinion. For example, the old optimistic humanists saw no drastic problems as they look at the present, but as they look into the future, the darkening cloud of problems casts shadows over their optimism, and you see the futures where their faith becomes weak. Or you have others like the idealistic anarchists, and they see desperate problems now. But what they do is place all their eggs in the basket of tomorrow and pin their faith in the triumph of progress, and so although the present may be apocalyptically dark, we can still believe in a good tomorrow and so have faith. In other words, the question utopia or oblivion is far more than intellectual curiosity. Finally, it's going to be a life or death issue for millions, crucially affecting modern man's view of himself. So the question is, which of the two is the more likely, utopia or oblivion? And we'll have to ask which side has the more evidence and the closer reasoning supporting its arguments. Secondly, futurology is important in relation to the Christian view of man, society, and the course of history. Because if the optimist is correct in saying that we're soon going to attain a utopia or whatever, then the Bible's got to be judiciously jettisoned or else drastically demythologized. But if, in fact, history aligns itself with biblical predictions, then modern man's going to have to treat the Bible much more seriously. But there's a third reason that's not just common to Christians, but to everybody. A third reason futurology is important is the fact that whichever way the future goes, there are going to be areas in which every responsible citizen is going to be called on to fight the general fights like dehumanization, totalitarianism, etc., as well as to raise specific moral and ethical questions in the name of humanness and freedom. This would be true for the Christian or the non-Christian. And we must understand these issues now in order to take an intelligent and a courageous stand later on. We're in a very fast-moving society. And in such a time, the man of principle can never afford to enter the debate thinking aloud as he goes, or he's going to get left behind. First of all, then, how do they construct these scenarios of the future? The basic aim of futurology is to ascertain what they call the futurables, the future possibilities. They use a bottom line of a graph which represents the unchangeables, and on the other hand, an upper line of the same graph which represents the unachievables. And between these, they set out to chart a graph of the human possibilities that are confronting us. In this graph, there are three areas. The first is the possible, which is the realm of the artist. The second is the probable, which is the realm of the scientist. And the third is the preferable, which is the realm of the politician, the preferable and the practical. Now, a word of warning in all this. Despite the fact futurology is very important, it's particularly dangerous to overemphasize it. As I said yesterday, at the end of every millennium, there's a time which is characteristically charged with the excitement of chiliasm or the expectancy of the imminent coming of the end. And this isn't just a Christian phenomenon. This happened around the year 1000. Many people headed for the tops of mountains waiting for the great flood to come. And it happens in non-Christian societies too. And probably the years before 2000 AD will be no exception. In fact, in such a climate, there are very, very peculiar temptations that are rife. For instance, the man whose cherished dreams are unlikely to be adopted this side of the last days will probably be forgiven if he hears with mixed emotions the beating of the apocalyptic hooves. He's got vested interest in these things arriving. But this becomes inexcusable if you have a situation in which all the doom criers of pop futurism tend only to make what in other circumstances would be intolerable, tend to make these tolerable simply because the future people have painted was so black that we're willing to opt for anything rather than the extremely black future. So we must be very, very careful the way we handle this. And many, many of the disciples of people like Hal Lindsey are guilty of this over-fearful preoccupation with the future. In the book The Year 2000 by Herman Kahn and Norbert Wiener, they offer scenarios which they call surprise-free projections. Very strong word, surprise-free projections. But most futurologists admit that what they're actually seeing is that there's a perilous instability to all projections. For instance, there's no verification of a single scenario that's talking about any second into the future. You either believe them or you don't. There may be a great amount of scientific reasoning behind them, but there's absolutely no verification for any one of them. After all, we have enough discussion to try and make the historians agree about what happened in the past, which is very elusive, so you wouldn't be surprised that the future is equally elusive and even more so. Toffler, in his book The Future Shock, compares the making of futurologists to map-making in the ancient world. When you actually arrived at the place you were setting out to discover, there wasn't very much relationship between the initial map and the country you found. So the map was very often in error, but it was a very useful guide to get you to the place you were going to. In just the same way today, the future is probably going to be entirely different from the scenarios projected by contemporary scientists. But they're very useful as kind of intellectual and sociological shoehorns to ease us in to the problems which we're going to face. Desmond King Healy, an English futurologist, is only honest when he admits that to try and live with your own predictions is rather like having to balance blindfold on an endless moving tightrope with knots that represent the current crises. So in other words, there are very hazardous problems and difficulties to make any scenario. And so we must approach them all with great humility. And the men should give them, incidentally, with great humility. But one word of warning is necessary. Many of these men cheat. And that's why I'd say very bluntly, it's always vital to examine the presuppositions of any particular forecaster. Because very often it's his premises, his presuppositions, which color the whole tone and standard of what he writes. Because optimism or pessimism is not just a matter of the evidence, it's also a matter of motivation plus temperament. Many, many of these people cheat. The book The End of the 20th Century by Desmond King Healy is a good example of this. He begins by saying that we should all be very wary of technological forecasters, because often their commercial interests stop them from having predictions that would outrage their backers. So you have a big corporation which has a think tank and says, produce us a projection for the next 15 years. Produces one which says their particular marketing quality is no good, so they sack the think tank. So they produce a slightly different one, somewhat more subtly, showing how it could be used, and then they kept on. So he says, beware that vested commercial interests are not behind this. And that's true, and he states this warning with commendable strength. But the interesting thing is that he then goes on himself to provide a striking parallel to this, and showing that not only commercial interests predetermine what you see, but also philosophical interests also predetermine what you see. For example, in his own book, there are very definite and very obvious presuppositions which run through from the very first page, and as he admits, they precondition the whole way he lays out the book. On page one he writes, the logical answer to the question, has man a future, is probably not. Or to be more accurate, man has many possible futures, but the most likely ones are all disastrous. Credible beginning. Disarming frankness and unusual honesty, he says this is the likely scenario, absolute disaster. But then he goes on to say we can't be morbid, and then he goes on, so in much of this book I shall display the blind optimism so typical of our species, and assume that however dismal humans, we shall somehow avoid the perils ahead and muddle through till the end of the century. Again, a very frank and engaging openness. And he confesses that this optimistic attitude will profoundly affect his whole method of treatment. So he continues. Disaster, then, is all too likely. But since most people, and double quotes, cannot bear very much reality, I have squeezed all the catastrophes into chapter 2, keeping the horrors to a minimum. Very frank admission that not just the commercial interests, but his own philosophical interests, as an optimist, condition the entire layout of the book and his conclusions. It's fascinating. His last chapter is called Perhaps. And every sentence that begins with if is optimistic. Every sentence that begins with unfortunately is pessimistic. And there's an exact relation between the two. Not all futurologists, of course, are so honest or reveal so clearly their presuppositions. But if we're not going to be misled, and this is true for us as Christians as well as any thinking non-Christian, we must really discover what the man's premises and presuppositions are. Futurology, like all philosophy, needs to be examined in the light of its premises. All intellectual presuppositions, commercial vested interests, and emotional preferences must be unmasked for an objective evaluation of their worth and solidity. Otherwise, the optimism we end up with may just be a fool's paradise, and our making of it will just be a house of cards. Now, an interesting place to begin, and one that's very instructive, would be to compare our present visions of the future with the visions of the future from men of the past. Let's look at these very briefly. Arthur Clarke has often said that the future can best be imagined today by those who are most familiar with the visions of the past. If you do a quick survey of many of the former utopias, you'll immediately see a striking difference between them and their counterparts in the 20th century. For example, in 1516, Thomas More wrote his Utopia, and he depicts the island with 54 well-designed towns, 6,000 households that are Spartan in their ideals and war-hating in their values, gardens for every house, and euthanasia for the decrepit, the first classic modern utopia. In 1872, Samuel Butler wrote Erewhon, foreseeing a land where people had risen up against machines and destroyed them completely for their own paradise. In 1891, William Morris wrote News from Nowhere, the story of a rural paradise set in the year 2012. And these three and other famous utopias in the past, like Plato's Republic, would be representative of the optimistic utopian projections of past generations. But if you start to list some of the modern titles, you'll immediately see the difference between them. For example, Aldous Huxley, The Brave New World, or Ireland. George Orwell's 1984, Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. C.S. Lewis, That Hideous Strength, Neville Shute's On the Beach. William Golding's Lord of the Flies. B.F. Skinner's Walden 2. Were you thinking? except for Skinner's Walden 2, all of those are predominantly pessimistic. And in fact, it's often the pessimistic ones which more strikes the vein of public thinking. Technically, they're not utopias at all, so much as dystopias or anti-utopias. And they cut very deeply into the vein of what Arnold Toynbee calls the modern failure of nerve. So much so, in fact, that Toffler complains that today we haven't even got the role of utopia writers. People whose projections that are optimistic can be shoehorns into the future. And he advocates the setting up of utopia factories. The difference between the extremes of optimism and pessimism seen in the past and the present could easily be symbolized, and is increasingly so, by two dates. And if you had to think through which date stands for optimism and which date stands for pessimism, which would you choose? Clearly, the year 1984 is eloquent in the connotations of an apprehensive foreboding of what's to come, while just the date, the year 2000, is fast becoming a shorthand sign for progressive confidence of technological optimism. You've probably seen that even Vila welcomes the tourists with a sign that declares the fact that Vila is preparing itself for the year 2000. It brings shivers of horror to most people. This is interesting because you see here immediately a tension between the two definitions of utopia. And you probably know that Thomas More was punning when he called his utopia. See, utopia either is spelled E-U-T, which is the Greek word for the good place, or utopia is spelled O-U-T, which is the Greek word for no place at all. And many of those who have most striven for the good place, which has been so beyond that it's been impossible, have ended up with a very ugly picture, which is no place at all. So Thomas More was an avid punster and built this into the very idea of utopia. So just in comparing the old ones with the modern ones, you see something immediately that tells you something about the modern tone of looking towards the future. Secondly, though, let's look at some of the profiles of the future that they see, the profiles of the future. We'll look in extremely general terms at the broad contours of the predicted future. The point here is not to see so much who we may think is the more correct, but to see the areas that are going to be particularly vital in the future, and also to note some of the profound moral, ethical, and human questions which are going to be raised. Now, common to all these profiles and predictions is the agreement, which we must understand, that we're on the threshold of a qualitatively different age. An age whose central hallmark is the acceleration of technology. Now, there are a host of different names for this age, but all of them strain to express that the central feature of our age is technological acceleration and advance. For instance, Daniel Bell describes it as post-industrial. Harvey Cox as technopolitan. Kenneth Boulding as post-civilization. Toffler as super-industrial. Zbigniew Brzezinski as the technotronic age. Martin McLuhan as the electric age. And Bertram Gross as the mobiletic revolution. Many, many new aims. But all of them are straining to express the fact that is the lowest common denominator is the extreme advance of technological acceleration. The essential idea is that vocabulary is being stretched to describe a society which has moved past its familiar landmarks and is progressing into a world of unexplored realities. Whether the literary qualifier is the voguish beyond, such as beyond tragedy, beyond capitalism, beyond this and that, or post, pretty well everything today is post-Christian, post-modern, post-this and that. The aim of all these expressions is to express the unique originality of the present moment. And we really need to appreciate this. Toffler puts it like this. If you took the history of man as 50,000 years on this planet and divided it into lifetimes of approximately 62 years each, then there would have been 800 such lifetimes of man. Of these 800, over 600 were spent very primitively. Only the last 70 with written communication, and only the last 6 with printed words. But of them all, the most crucial of all would be our lifetime, the 800th. This one lifetime is the center of history, in the sense that as much is happening in this one lifetime as in all the previous ones put together. The British physicist and Nobel Prize winner, Sir George Thomson, compares the importance of our age with the invention of agriculture in Neolithic times. It's that much of a watershed. Herbert Reed feels that the difference between our age and previous ages is equivalent to the difference between the old and the new stone ages. Whichever type of comparison you see, most are agreeing that time is speeding up And just as water at a certain point changes to steam, so history is becoming volatile because technology is accelerating so fast. Now, these broad contours can be followed through in four important areas, and we'll go through these very quickly. First, planetary engineering. Second, global engineering. Thirdly, biological engineering. And fourthly, sociological change. Four important areas, and we'll just see very, very briefly and sketchily some of the contours that they're showing us. First of all, then, planetary engineering. This is the first, but for our purposes, very much the least important of the four. Many, many questions being raised. Are there going to be lunar bases by 75? Are we going to have air-conditioned lunar settlements by 2000? Will man soon discover an alternative to rocket propulsion and thus rapidly accelerate even more space discovery? Will space travelers soon travel in regulated comas? Could we soon have cyborg manned space crews? Is it feasible, as certain American scientists are working on plans, to make Mars and Venus habitable? Is it possible to dismantle and rebuild Jupiter? All such questions, and questions like these are endless. But the point is that they're far from being science fiction fantasies. They raise questions for the psychology of man as he bores out into space, and they demand that we count the cost of such programs in the light of the problems that we're leaving behind to be tackled on Earth. But for our purposes, they're vital because they raise the profound and crucial human questions and moral questions in many other areas. We'll pick these up later. The second area is global engineering. How will future communications, for instance, change and shape the life of man or expand and limit his power? Because what's being predicted is nothing short of the availability of instant, total information in the future. This will depend on each progressive country having several things. For instance, a belt of satellites going around the world. In the particular country, a whole grid network of computer data banks. And in each citizen's home, a gigantic thing like what's being called in England the World Box, a kind of wall-to-ceiling, wall-to-wall television screen, providing you all the amenities of public libraries, television, shopping guides, cinemas, newspapers, encyclopedias, university courses. Instant, total information. But of course, this would also mean that the state, and that would include the police force, would have instant, total information available on the private citizen. And you can see in areas like this in communication, such progress is always double-edged. You could go into other sort of areas, for instance, like the aquaculture and the oceans, the question of weather control. And I'll miss out many things, like the topographical change. I'll just skip through these things because we haven't time to go into them. The third area is biological engineering, which Nigel Calder describes as the most radical of all technologies. Here we meet a whole host of questions. Quantitative change is already a feature of modern living. And soon we're going to have improved self-realization and mood control through drugs and electrodes, etc., etc. Human intelligence can be speeded up through drugs or fetal oxygenation. Children already treated this way, incidentally, already show a precocious ability. You can control sleep and dreaming, and we will be able to do so even more in the future. And maybe they'll even be able to lengthen the human lifespan. But the real question will not be quantitative change, but qualitative change through genetic control. For the first time, the human body will no longer be a fixed given. Cloning, which is the creation of biological carbon copies of human cells, will be possible probably within 15 years, they're saying. And people are making prognostications of the possibility of frozen embryos and all sorts of other things. Thus, a woman could buy an embryo free of genetic defect, the guaranteed sex and choice of eye color, hair color, and the IQ within a certain range. And this could then be implanted by a doctor. And in the future, a little beyond that, they're promising the possibility of birth even without human pregnancy. For example, the possibility of the human embryo carried within a cow for 9 months, thus avoiding, quote, the nuisance of pregnancy, which the women's lib people are talking about so often. To many, this is still a morally distasteful idea, but to several of the more outspoken women's lib people, this is already a cardinal tenet of their hope, and this is promised to us by the science of tomorrow. Or what about the possibility of machine-man symbiosis? Cyborgs, disembodied human brains in robot bodies, or humanoid machines indistinguishable from men, And in this area, there's a whole host of suggestions, ranging from the eminently practical to the very bizarre and the extraordinary. A scientist at Washington State University suggests that we ship fertilized human eggs to the planets so that a whole population for a city could be sent in a shoebox. The British biologist J.B.S. Haldane suggests that man should be adapted for space travel. Maybe, for instance, a man with a tail would be better adapted than a man without a tail, and so on. In other words, the human body is fitted for this earth, but as we go out, we may need to adapt it totally to other worlds. Professor H.D. Block of Cornell University claims that man-machine sex relationships will be practicable and desirable very, very soon. Gordon Rattray Taylor sees the time when you could have a paranoid dictator who could keep his brain alive in a bulletproof robot body, etc., etc. Now, all these sort of projections are a veritable breeding ground of fantasies and fears and questions. For instance, should we propose a breed of smaller men? Will there be sons born 100 years after their father's death? If we can create carbon copies of an Einstein, a T.S. Eliot, or a Picasso, who's to prevent the duplication of carbon copies of Hitler or Stalin? And even if we do prevent it, who's to choose? And on what basis will they choose? And above all, what is the criterion for humanness? In other words, is there a difference to man, and does it make a difference? The answer to these questions are beyond the reach of post-Christian humanism. And even standing on its toes, it cannot reach to untie the Damoclean sword that just seems to dangle above its head when it looks into this sort of world. The fourth area is the area of sociological change. And here we must understand that many familiar features of contemporary societies are going to be altered beyond recognition. For instance, work, as we now know it, will no longer be the basis of society. Nor will even the service industries, as in many advanced countries, hold the present importance they have today. But the key thing will be communications. Communications and the transference of information. This will be supreme. This will mean all sorts of things. For example, the shift from blue-collar workers to white-collar workers, the rise of mass leisure, and above all, the ascendant importance of education, now not just as a training for life, but as an industry in itself. Another thing that's going to change will be art and aesthetics. Sir Herbert Read, the great British art historian, contributing to the book The World in 1984, predicted that art and literature as we now know them may have died out by 1984. Whether this becomes true or not, others are suggesting that the trend of aesthetics in the future will be the attempt to simulate human experience in every area by the so-called experience makers. Even the realm of production and factories will be psychologized. Everything geared in line with making humans appreciate the simulation of every human experience they want. You can see some initial hints of this trend already. For example, on a very, very simple level, a place like London's Oxford Street is changing its face completely. On the way out are the old large superstores. And in their place are coming in all sorts of small boutiques with a kind of medieval intimacy, a variety and an involvement on every level in colour and sound. The traditional decor of many of the English pubs is changing. For instance, you have a living simulation of a pub like a ship, complete with detailed design and authenticity of a captain's cabin and the whole stairways cabin, etc., etc., to give you a total experience and not just a pint of beer. There's a place in New York called Cerebrum, which describes itself as an electronic studio of participation. You go in, take off your clothes, and get the plastic clothes, and you go in for a total evening of sight, color, sound, taste, flowing around you, really to simulate every possible human experience. In England, Joan Littlewood is working in what she calls pleasure palaces of the future. And as these are described, they'll probably simulate human experiences and combine the pleasures in one of places like Disneyland, the World's Fair, Cape Kennedy, Mayo Clinic, and the Macau Honky Tonk all roll into one place. Just pay your money and in you go. That's why such a thing, that thing that you showed me, Donna, in Time magazine is so sickening. The fact that Moses sells better than Mickey Mouse, and the Christians in Tennessee have built this ghastly place. What's it called? Holy Land. What an absolutely sickening thing. And I hope some Christian has the integrity to go and blow it up. But all this, you see, will be an attempt to psychologize environments and entertainment. And it'll be a kind of new mood engineering. Constantly, they're trying to simulate varied experiences of human happiness. And if you don't see what this points to, not just to crassly materialistic attitudes, it's also remarkably reminiscent of the key concept of Brave New World, which was happiness. The creation of a happy consciousness, because people are made happy by their experiences. Or a third thing under sociology, the family. Clearly, the present importance of the family will be lost irrevocably. In the past, the family has served for two things sociologically. First, society's shock absorber against change. Secondly, the basic transmitter of social values. But both of these benefits will go. For instance, we're bound to lose something of the mystique of motherhood if parents can just go into a babytorium and select the embryo of their own choice. And if soon we can bypass pregnancy, the very strength of motherhood is going to be sapped. And if embryos can be conceived by other parents, and even by multi-parents, parenthood too, the very notions of parenthood are going to have to be revised. If embryos are purchased, who are the parents? Could a corporation, for example, buy an embryo and own an embryo for its own work for the whole of its life? Furthermore, the family, this is another factor, is going to be streamlined to its most basic components. Compare this with the Victorian household. In the Victorian household, you might have had a family with two parents, 8, 9, 10, or 11, 15 kids, the maiden aunt who helped care for the kids, and possibly the grandparents on both sides, all living in one great rumbustuous house. But today this is described technically by as a child-cluttered family. And they say that the family of the future will be stripped down even further to the basic unit of just husband and wife, maybe with children only after retirement when they've got time, where professional parents would replace biological parents, and the latter would become scorned as the greatest single preserve of the amateur. That's interesting. It's true that parenthood is the one great responsible role in society for which pretty well no one has much clue before their parents. So they'll remove it and introduce professional parents rather than biological parents. In the place of the family unit is suggested communes of all kinds, religious, political, geriatric, and certainly the increase in single unmarried adults having children, homosexual marriages with children, and the legalization of brother-sister marriages. Polygamy, too, may be practiced again. But the essential feature of the marriage relationship will be its impermanence and transience. In other words, there'll be temporary, serial, trial marriages where the stage and not the age is the vital thing. So maybe you have a trial marriage and you're at university. If you dig the person, you'll live with them during your business years or whatever. If you don't, you marry someone else, and so on. In his 1946 To the Brave New World, which was written in the 30s, Huxley predicted that marriage licenses would be sold like dog licenses, good for 12 months at a time and as many as you like at one time. Now understand that in this time, the Christian conception of marriage will not just be considered mistaken, it will be dismissed as absolutely meaningless. And it will be as novel as Christian morality was in pagan Rome. And remember that when Christian views of morality and chastity burst on the scene, people just laughed, just rocked with laughter when they thought of such things. It was ludicrous not to have homosexual relationships in Greece. Mistresses were not the exception, they were the rule. Now, Toffler is typical of this when he describes with disdain what to us is a good description of the Christian view of marriage. Toffler describes with complete scorn how, quote, the orthodox format of marriage presupposes that the two young people will find one another and marry. It presupposes that the two will even fulfill certain psychological needs in one another, and that the two personalities will develop over the years more or less in tandem so that they continue to fulfill each other's needs. It further actually presupposes that this process will last until death do us depart. And he summarizes this as an acrobatic feat of matched development. And that's exactly what the Christian presupposes in asking God to lead him to the right person, knowing that in Christ they can develop in tandem over the years, and that because of the cross there is always forgiveness, and because of this, 1,000 fresh beginnings. But Toffler, not having this presupposition, laughs out of court what he calls the orthodox format of marriage. And we must really recognize we'll very much be the odd men out in such a day. He's got nothing but scorn for what we call a conception of Christian coupleness. Now, this may be regrettable for many humanists to appreciate the morality that's around today, but it will be inevitable if things go on as they're around now. None of us should have any illusions. Without a genuine Christian basis for this reality, any attempt to maintain the traditional format is only going to be an exercise in hollow hypocrisy and a losing cause. One last thing under sociology, and that's religion. Here there are various conflicting reports as to what's going to happen. Some people predict with certainty that religion is going to decline and disappear, and we're going to have society completely enveloped by secularism. Desmond King Healy is an example of a man who has the impertinence even to suggest that Christians should erect disposable churches so they can be dismantled as soon as the supernatural beliefs die out. And this sort of prediction fits in well with Bonhoeffer's diagnosis of the religionless age, or C.S. Lewis's Unchristening of the West. A second group, however, see not the disappearance of religion, but a change of status. In other words, with a final foundering of its hidebound institutionalism, contemporary Christianity may lose the consensus decisively, but it will not disappear. Rather, they say, it will take on a new lease of life, thriving on the disappearance of former problems such as science against faith, and we'll see an emergence of an informal, dynamic faith shared above all in cell groups from home to home. And certainly the last 10 years have witnessed the most amazing proliferation of thousands of these home groups for fellowship, worship, and study, and this could well be a pattern of things to come. But a third group go beyond this altogether and claim that what we're beginning to see is the end of secularism and the arrival of an increase in religious feeling. Marshall McLuhan says, "We're heading into a profoundly religious age." Paul Goodman, analyzing the counterculture, admits that he made a mistake in his earlier analysis, and he now writes, "I imagine that the worldwide student protest had to do with changing political institutions, to which I was sympathetic. But I now see that what we have to do with is a religious crisis in the magnitude of the Reformation in the 1500s. Very interesting statement. Some people dismiss this new religiosity as a last stirring of religion in its death throes. But actually, the evidence points elsewhere. That's why I was saying the other night that Schrager was a bit out of date with his trying to make science against religion. It's very much the other way. But we must be very clear about the essential features of this new resurgence. This is not a revival of historic Christianity with truth and content and objective grounds for faith, but rather of religious experience and of pluralism, if not perversity. And the mark of this is that faith is contentless, and often experience can be counterfeit, and both are vulnerable to manipulation." That's what I talk about in another lecture on the ultimate trip. G.K. Chesterton, the great Christian, once remarked that when people cease to believe in God, they do not believe in nothing, they believe in anything. Oswald Spengler said that the decline of the West would be marked by a fervid religiosity in the closing years. And it certainly looks as if a cheapness and confusion of religion will be the religious climate of our next years. Now this means, incidentally, that it's twice as easy for a Christian to speak into the situation, but it's twice as hard to speak into it intelligibly. And we mustn't mistake the easiness which it is to speak about God and Jesus for the fact that we're making sense. More usually, one longs for the good old days of atheism when you knew where people were. People say, "Jesus, Jesus, God, God, God," and it means nothing today. And we need to really put content into it. Faith that is faddish is just as dangerous as faith that is false. So these then are the profiles of the future. And that's a very, very selective summary. But it does silhouette some of the broad profiles of the future that are now being envisaged. And as I said, though, these are important not so much because of whether or not they're inaccurate, but rather because you can see the type of questions and issues that are being raised in these areas. Now, as we look at these and the people who are making these predictions, it's hardly surprising that there's a wide difference between those who are enthusiastic in their optimism and those who are sober in their pessimism. And here we'll look next at this polarization between the two, the enthusiastic optimists and the sober pessimists. Let's first take the optimists and then we'll have a break. Among the prophets of optimism, there are two types: those with a virtually unqualified optimism and those with a conditional optimism. The former, the unqualified optimists, generally presuppose the achievement, or the imminent possibility of achieving, real change in human society, or real change in human nature, or a real change in the human consciousness. And one of those three things is vital to have a basis for optimism. either a qualitative change in society, or man in society, or a new consciousness in man in society. One of those, or all three, or a mixture of them, must be there, a fundamental prerequisite for optimism. The 19th century was rich in prophecies of optimism. Ernest Renan, the French atheist, predicted in 1876 that technological man would create new men who would be like gods. The positivist in France, Auguste Comte, foresaw utopia led by an elite of managers and scientists in the 20th century. As you know, Karl Marx promised a communist utopia, which has become the most powerful social myth in our times. Although, in fact, Khrushchev is more realistic of being among those who have scaled down Marx's utopia to what he called goulash and ballet. That's all he offered. But the 19th century utopians were really optimistic in what they proclaimed. More recently, we have a very different type of utopianism, but the confidence burns just as brightly. Here we'll look at a few people. Some of them I'll go into a bit of depth, and others just quickly. First of all, Skinner of Harvard. We'll look at him. B.F. Skinner of Harvard promises progress through conditioning. And this promise is both in his scientific writings and in his utopian novel, Walden 2. He says if we ignore conditioning, we're just going to go on enduring the present poor results of freedom, which is only an extension of illusion. If we use conditioning, which he calls behavioral technology, then man can at last achieve a society that guarantees survival, common pleasure, and benevolence, and we can really have hope in man. Now, regardless of whether or not we accept Skinner's determinism, we cannot ignore his central thesis, because today it's possible to control man. The question is, do we want to, in the way he says? Skinner's argument says that freedom was okay in the past, but freedom is running riot today because of individualism, and it's threatening Western culture with disintegration. Anyway, he says, what we call freedom and free will and inner choice are really only an illusion. So man flatters himself when he thinks that he ever initiates something, or originates something, or creates something. The fact is that any action man has is really created by his environment, so the behavior is conditioned by the consequences of behavior. In other words, freedom is an illusion. Autonomy is a superstition which only originated in man's inability to understand himself. And now we can understand ourselves, we can remove the dangerous illusion of freedom and totally condition ourselves. I'll say a bit more about Skinner than some of the others. Most critics of Skinner direct their criticism not so much at the soundness of his lab work on rats and pigeons, but rather the fact that he's extended this lab work over into natural philosophy and politics. And in this area, the implications are starkly totalitarian. If you've read Walden 2, Skinner has there that the main character is his alter ego, T.E. Frazier. T.E. Frazier is the founder director of the utopian community, and he openly admits in one place, I quote, "I've had only one idea in my life, a true fixed idea, to put it as bluntly as possible, the idea of having my own way. Control," expressed it as I think, "the control of human behavior. In my early experimental days, it was a frenzied, selfish desire to dominate. I remember the rage I used to feel when a prediction went awry. I could have shouted at the subjects of my experiments, 'Behave, damn you! Behave as you ought!'" So here's the director of his community. The desire to control, to dominate, to really have totalitarian control over. Now, in the book that came out last year, in Beyond Freedom and Dignity, Skinner puts the same point much less dramatically, but equally forcefully. This is what Skinner says. "What is being abolished is autonomous man, the inner man. His abolition has long been overdue. Autonomous man is only a device used to explain what we cannot explain in any other way." And you can see that in Skinner's book, the most crucial question of the end of our century, the question, chaos or control, is sharpened to its finest point. He says, unless we control, there will be chaos, therefore we must control. And the closing words of Skinner's book are the cue to maybe the struggle of the end of our century. He closes with these words, "We have not yet seen what man can make of man." Here's his whole thesis. Unless we control is chaos, therefore control, and then we'll have an optimistic confidence in the world tomorrow. Incidentally, you can see from the early works of utopias like Plato's Republic, right down to Walden 2, always two lessons emerge in this utopian writings. First is this. The utopian mentality is spawned, it finds a natural breeding ground in periods of the social disintegration. Plato wrote at the chaos of the Peloponnesian Wars. Thomas More wrote during the chaos of the 16th century struggles in England. Skinner wrote Walden 2 at the end of the chaos of World War II. Each of them, in other words, was attempting to build via his utopia a private bridge between the prevalent chaos and his hope for solution. So in other words, it had a motivation in the period. The second lesson of utopias is this. The consequent romanticism of the utopian concept is almost invariably dictatorial. Plato's Republic is called proto-fascist. It's a very primitive fascism. The fact is, the history of man's utopias is the best argument against utopias. Lewis Mumford wrote about utopias. As with the old Greek innkeeper Procrustes, the utopians either have to stretch them to the arbitrary dimensions of the utopian bed, or they lop off its limbs. In other words, man either fits into your preconceived ideas, or you remove whatever is embarrassing to you. The Russian philosopher Nikolai Berdyaev warned this. It's an interesting warning. Utopias seem very much more realizable than we formerly supposed. Now we find ourselves facing a question which is painful in a new kind of way. How to avoid their realization? In other words, the old question was, how on earth could you get the utopia here? Now we're saying, how can we keep them away? There is a menace in this idealistic quest for perfection, such as Skinner suggests, for such romanticism is always the womb of the death wish. There's a first man. Now, we could mention many, many others. For example, Richard Landers, who's the physicist, or Marshall McLuhan, or Teilhard de Chardin, many of these people. But I'll skip these out because of lack of time. We could mention many, many other optimistic views, ranging from political visions like Marcuse's down to scientific scenarios like Arthur Clarke's. But almost invariably, with all of these, their conclusions are weakened, if not betrayed, at one of three points. And look for these when you read these. Some of them are short on necessary evidence. In other words, it would be all right if they had the evidence. Secondly, some are tenuous in their reasoning. Thirdly, some stumble over the fact that they include contradictory evidence. Evidence which they think points towards optimism, but which, when you really closely examine it, points a very different way. So this is sweeping, because I've left out a lot of the evidence of the argument here. But optimism in many of these areas is a hope, but it is not a fully rational empirical belief, because it has no strong basis. And at worst, it's often a blind romanticism. This is particularly so of Teilhard de Chardin. But I'll just mention a few things, although I haven't been really fair to him, because I haven't mentioned his hopes yet. Teilhard de Chardin's classic is a man who falls short in all three of those areas. And this is most striking in his book, The Future of Man, if you've ever read that, a Penguin paperback. Chapter 8, for example, of this book is called Some Reflections on the Spiritual Repercussions of the Atom Bomb. And Teilhard de Chardin is unique among contemporary prophets in finding the atom bomb a symbol of hope rather than apocalyptic disaster. Quite extraordinary. But even this romanticism pales by comparison with his next chapter, which is called Faith in Peace. I'll just read out a quote. Everything that formerly made for war is now making for peace. Mankind is not only capable of living in peace, but by its very structure cannot fail eventually to achieve peace. The earth is more likely to stop turning than is man as a whole likely to stop unifying itself. Peace, therefore, is certain. It's only a matter of time. You only need to read such statements as that without a shred of evidence given for them. You only need to read them aloud against the background broadcast of the evening news to feel a yawning distance between his vision and where we really are. That's what I mean by a blind romanticism. All of these views, whether romantic, are ably summarized in the closing passage of Scott Fitzgerald's novel, The Great Gatsby, where he finishes, Gatsby believed in a green light. The orgiastic future, that year by year recedes before us. It eluded us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow we will run faster. Tomorrow we will stretch out our arms further. That's what so many of these people believe, sound like, when you actually come down to it. Now, we'll break for a couple of minutes. Thank you. all of those, and I apologise, I missed out a section on that, would be under the unconditional optimists. And now we'll look at the conditional optimists. I'm just mentioning two recent books. First is The Technological Man by Victor Firkis. Firkis is optimistic in the sense that he sees humanity on the threshold of a new self-transfiguration, of genuinely attaining new powers over itself and of altering its own nature. But he says, this is possible, but he adds a cautionary warning. It's only possible if. And the if is that he says, culturally, economically, politically, sociologically, there's no sign of the new man yet. In other words, we can be optimistic if, but there's no sign of the new man yet. So any toasts or celebrations are premature. And the actual reality is lagging a long way behind prospects or hope. In fact, he says, we're in a very dangerous situation. Because we're subordinating man to technology. And we're subordinating technology to pre-technological values. Excuse me. Let me quote from him. What emerges today as the pattern for the future is not technological man, in other words, a man fitted to his technology, so much as neo-primitive man trapped in a technological environment. Technological man does not yet exist. His job is to invent not the future, but first of all himself. Or as he puts it elsewhere, bourgeois man is still in the saddle. Or to put it more accurately, things are in the saddle, since bourgeois man is increasingly unable to cope with his problems. He concludes, the synthesis of postmodern technology and industrial man could produce a new civilization, or it could mean the end of the human race. In other words, you can be optimistic if the new man is there, but there's no sign anywhere in all these areas he looks into of the new man yet. So it's conditional optimism. The second is Toffler's book, The Future Shock, a brilliant and a very exciting and optimistic book, although sometimes the exuberant overall confidence is too strong to fit in with the confines of his original thesis. As with Firkis, he believes strongly in the possibility of a brilliant future, but the question is, can we achieve it? And here the key weakness for Toffler is man's adaptive ability. In other words, man's ability to adapt to the fast-changing pace of society, which he calls future shock. I quote, unless man quickly learns to control the rate of change in his personal affairs, we are doomed to a massive adaptational breakdown. So yes, the future's great if. Jung had earlier warned, today we have plunged down a cataract of progress, which sweeps us on into the future with ever wilder violence the further it takes us from our roots. And Toffler picks up this as his text and puts it in the context of accelerating technology and claims that too much change in too short a time will lead to future shock, or what he calls the dizzying disorientation. And he thinks that this will give rise to a growth of mass irrationalism, which to him will be the new cancer in history. Now, Toffler is not speaking of the world which is 70% still agricultural, nor of the world which is still 24% still industrial, but of the remaining percentage of the world which is very small, which is differentiated not by race, religion, or ideology, but by the rapid changes of the acceleration of technology. And he says there are three factors by which technology is just thrusting down upon us. First of all, transience, removing all the previous permanence, stability. Secondly, novelty, removing all the previous familiarity. And thirdly, diversity, removing all the previous uniformity. And this provides a triple thrust of the future shock. And he gives a lot of evidence for this, which is fascinating. It's certainly a book that all of you ought to read. There's a lot of minute insights as well as wide generalizations, but the overall thesis is cautionary. And I'll quote again. When diversity converges with transience and novelty, we rocket society towards an historical crisis of adaptation. We create an environment so ephemeral, so unfamiliar, and so complex as to threaten millions with adaptive breakdown. And this breakdown is future shock. Again, and with all these men, I'm not having time to do justice to any of them. But what you can see is that they're both conditional optimists. Yes, a very bright future if, for Firkis, if the new man arrives, but he's not there yet. Toffler, if we can survive future shock, and at the moment there are signs that we aren't. So all those together, the conditional and the unconditional, are on the side of the optimists. And now let's turn to the pessimists. On the other side, and increasingly representing a polarized alternative to the optimists, are the various prophets of pessimism. And the best approach here is to mention the various leading thinkers in this variety and to outline not so much what they're saying, but the various pointers to pessimism, or the pressure points of problems, or as some have described them, the data of doom. In other words, I'm not going through the individual man saying this is his theory, this is his, but it's rather looking at the total picture of the pressure points which are bringing the problems. Each of these pressure points is a problem in itself, but each of them by themselves is not enough. Rather, it's their aggregate force which makes them a sobering consideration. What sort of men am I talking about here? Well, people like Paul Ehrlich, Gordon Rattray Taylor, Isaac Asimov, and Bertrand Russell. These are representative of many others of a wide range of voices on the pessimistic side. Asimov describes himself as a doom crier. Rattray Taylor prefaces his book, The Doomsday Book, with a lengthy quotation from the woes of Revelation 7 to 9. And Bertrand Russell is typical of this side when he made a very stoic statement at the end of his life. The man who wishes to preserve sanity in a dangerous world should summon up in his own mind a parliament of fears in which each in turn is voted absurd by all the others. But what Russell apparently neglected was the unfortunate possibility of a unanimous vote. And that's what some people are saying we're now facing. Interestingly also, even the predictions of the optimists are peppered with premonitions of disasters at some point. Even Teilhard de Chardin, for all that I just quoted and for all his buoyant blitheness, wrote just before he died in his diary, "Man now sees that the seeds of his ultimate dissolution are at the heart of his being. The end of the species is in the marrow of our bones." And that's why I quoted Norman O'Brown, normally an incredible romantic, but saying, "Today even the survival of humanity is a utopian hope." Perhaps most sobering of all is the Russell-Einstein Manifesto, which was given in 1955 at the Caxton Hall, London, just 2 days before Einstein died. The manifesto was outlining the risks of thermonuclear warfare, and it bluntly warned, quote, "We have found that the men who know the most are always the most gloomy." A statement which by its notable pedigree, in other words, the great scientist Einstein and the greatest living contemporary philosopher Russell, should falsify the myth that realists are just reactionary Jeremiahs. Far from it. The manifesto went on, quote, "We appeal as human beings to human beings. Remember your humanity and forget the rest. If you do so, the way lies open to a new paradise. If you cannot, there lies before you the risk of universal death." The implicit relationship of realism and pessimism in 1955 was almost prophetic of our present situation. Incidentally, this is captured perhaps even better in some of the later photographs of Bertrand Russell, if any of you have seen those. His whole features, you know, he just looked like a sort of bird himself. And his hooked nose, strongly aquiline, he just looked like a brave eagle looking out over the abyss. And the photographs are just a brilliant study in his own philosophy of oblique bravery in the face of realism and despair. All right, but what are these data of doom, or the various pressure points? Well, remember the two that Firkus and Toffler raise, that there's no sign of a new man yet, and the contemporary man is not adequately coping with future shock. We'll just leave those aside for the moment. I'd like to outline 10 further pressure points, and think of these individually and aggregately. First, what are called the apocalyptic horsemen. In other words, the related problems of war, disease, famine, and death. All of those should be obvious, and I'll just say a few words about each. In regard to war, we have a situation today in which we have unlimited power to destroy the planet. And yet the world is still divided into over 100 competing nations. And few national leaders are totally conspicuous for their reasonableness and constant statesmanship. As John Kennedy said in a speech to the United Nations in 1961, "Mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind." Speaking of the obvious fear of some monumental error of judgment, Desmond King Healy writes, "The logical conclusion is that the weapons are likely to be let loose, probably before the end of the 20th century. Some say it'll be an accident, some an error of misinformed judgment, some just an arrogance of power. But whichever way, many people suspect that we're really, what's happening today is that each of these threats is casting a long shadow over every aspect of meaningful existence. Obviously, the most current expression of this is our fear of the atom bomb and the mushroom cloud. Although, if you ever notice, it's a fascinating thing that before the atom bomb was there, people feared it. Now it's there, actually, very much fewer people believe that the world will go up by it. It's a very interesting psychological phenomenon. Now that the threat is real and not just anticipated, many people have suddenly ceased to believe in a major nuclear war. Similarly, though, the specter of disease and famine should need little elaboration, particularly with a generation like ours, contemporary, say, with the tragedy of Bangladesh. Even apart from a war situation, possible pandemics, epidemics on a huge scale, are forecast because of overcrowding and malnutrition, including fears of cholera and bubonic plagues. Speaking of famine, Ehrlich sounds an alarm. The next 9 years will tell the story. And he's speaking there of whether or not the world will be able to solve the food problem. The second pressure point is the fear of a population crash. Not the explosion, but a crash. In other words, the culmination of the population explosion. Whatever people say the upper estimates for the ceiling of human population are, some say 30 billion, 25, 50 billion, whatever, most forecasters agree that there are no sufficient foreseeable solutions. For example, some are dreaming of breeding micro-men to fit into the world better, or constructing a gigantic building to encircle the whole Earth 70 stories high, or else sending people to other planets and getting rid of them, all these sort of notions. But none of these solutions would be sufficient. Now the point is, the population explosion cannot go on indefinitely. As the Academy of Sciences in America reported, either the birth rate of the world must come down, or the death rate must go back up. Why do they fear the population crash? Well, simply, scientists who studied nature's mechanism to control overcrowding have projected this onto the human situation. In the animal world, when you have overcrowding, first of all, there's a loss of fertility, then an inadequate mothering, extreme neuroses, finally violence and a stress that endangers life itself, and just a dying off. And this has been witnessed in the world of the microbes. We'll have a crash like that in AD 2250. Population will have reached 25 billion, and there'll be a crash back down to 2 billion, with a death of 23 billion people. Of course, another 300 years, we'll just repeat the cycle all over again. Then we must remember that generally population forecasts have been, generally speaking, too low. Many people predict that the 25 billion will be reached within the next century, and Rattray Taylor even before that, the population crash. The third pressure point is ecology. With possible disasters from one of two places, either unforeseen imbalances or pollution. And I shouldn't need to go into either of those with all the interest that our generation has in ecology. A fourth pressure point is the fear of a genetics race. This is already being advocated in the Soviet Union, who are urging that Russia should gain a decisive lead in the strategic area of biological engineering. In other words, create a new race of men who will be useful for war, etc., etc. And I'm told that the replies to those who are arguing for this, or rather, those who are arguing for this, as they reply to their humanitarian critics, are replying in arguments which are coldly terrifying. You know, Fred Hoyle has predicted, in 25 years' time, it will be the biologists who are working behind barbed wires. In other words, today the physicists are the key men producing the nuclear bomb, etc. But in 25 years' time, it will be the biological engineering and the production of a whole breed of new men, a genetics race, far, far more important than the arms race. A fifth pressure point is the fear of a rising anti-scientism. For many people, Hiroshima is the symbol of the forbidden fruit which was eaten and the age of innocence was lost, unlike Teilhard de Chardin, who took it the other way around. Many are charging that science has reached the point of destructive returns. And isn't it interesting that the Superman image of the scientist is gradually disappearing and is being replaced by the former image of the scientist as the dreamer, or the mad engineer who produces as many problems as he does breakthroughs. And you can see this reflected in popular attitudes, such as the growing preferences for the non-scientific and university disciplines. And in the 50s, science departments were packed, but more and more today, people are going into the art departments and so on, sociology. But it's interesting, too, that this rising anti-scientism is evident even among scientists themselves. And you can see in many, many books the metaphor of science as a runaway train. Here's Nigel Calder, the English writer. The apparent inability of the species to make discriminating use of science induces a sense of helplessness. The impression is that we're passengers in a runaway train, and there seems to be no one in the driving cab. Or say from the States, a physicist, Ralph Lapp, he writes very similarly. No one, and certainly not even the most brilliant scientist alive today, really knows where science is taking us. We're aboard a train racing down a track on which there are unknown number of switches leading to unknown destinations. No single scientist is in the engine cab, and there may be demons at the switch. And most of society is in the caboose looking backwards. You can see just an irrational mood rather than a specific thought of a mood of anti-scientism, which is dangerous because we'll need science. A sixth pressure point is the tyranny of technology. I'll examine this much fuller tomorrow afternoon. But its urgency presses us at this point also. For example, the human, aesthetic, and moral considerations are being ousted by the technological. The little phrase of a thing can be done, it must be done. But we're looking all into this tomorrow. And the omnicompetence of technology is very much seen to be not infallible at all. Gordon Ratchet Taylor says, technology is what makes the numbers possible. Numbers are what makes technology so dangerous. Toffler describes technology as that great growling engine of change. And people are saying, can we stop technology? Jacques Ellul, and we'll look at him again tomorrow afternoon, says this is a pious hope with no chance whatever of influencing technical evolution. The further we advance, the more the purpose of our technique fades out of hope. In other words, many, many people are now seeing that technology too is creative but highly double-edged and is really causing many problems on modern man, but we'll look at this tomorrow. The seventh pressure point is the shortage of time. Never have scientific and technological innovations been introduced faster, and never have their implications been more far-reaching. Yet moral and political decisions are as slow as ever. H.G. Wells warned that the end of the world would be a race between education and catastrophe. But it's one thing to listen to a warning, quite another to act on it. It's interesting how the books like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring were scorned at first as unscientific. And examples like this should make us sit up and listen to a recent warning on ecology when a man in the States said, what makes these thoughts all the more disturbing is the knowledge that our fate could perhaps be sealed 20 or more years before the development of the symptoms. Technology is accelerating so fast that the symptoms arrive, and by the time they do, it's too late to deal with the root causes. This is interesting, as we were seeing yesterday. Just 20 years ago, the humanists saw themselves controlling their evolution with millions of years of time at their disposal. But today the estimates are more pinched. But few people are speaking in terms of more than 300 years as a realistic estimate, and some are only speaking in terms of decades. This is hardly the confident picture of the optimistic humanist. Man is really fighting desperately for his very survival. An eighth pressure point is the moral vacuum. Never has so much responsibility been called for, but never has the need been so marked by the logic of relativism. Toffler speaks of a value vertigo, and many are viewing the coming ethical discussions as a biological witch's brew that is seething in laboratories. As I said, by what values will man choose? Are we going to try and create ourselves like gods? Do we need a new Bill of Rights to safeguard humanness? In this situation, science has nothing to say, and those who try to adduce moral values from science or evolution either fail in their attempts or produce an immorality which is even more dangerous. Victor Firkis captures this brilliantly, talking about morals and technology. He says, modern man is far from slaying the beast within him. Why do we assume that the man of the future will be a completely new creature? What if the new man combines the animal irrationality of primitive man with the calculated greed and power lust of industrial man while still possessing the virtual godlike powers granted him by technology? This would be the ultimate horror. In other words, we've got super-industrial powers, but neo-primitive lusts. His prognosis, incidentally, is almost a crossbreeding of Huxley's earlier Brave New World and Huxley's later Ape in Essence. Any of you have read the second novel? the moral vacuum. A ninth pressure point is the problem of vested interests. In other words, those things which prevent effective action being taken. Barry Commoner in the area of pollution says that most American farmers have had a nitrogen jag for so long that they've become addicted and they're not going to give it up. And what's true of private greed is also very true of large industrial corporations and government projects like nuclear research and religious attitudes like the Roman Catholic attitude towards birth control. Justice Douglas, William Douglas in the States, described the American government attitude towards nuclear research as a light-hearted approach to the most awesome, the most deadly, the most dangerous process that man has ever conceived. Why? In the name of defense, they're rushing ahead with nuclear research, careless of some of the possibilities of the various problems that come in its wake. My wife knows it. This is typical of many people in the fight for ecology. My wife knows a young American attorney who at the same time defended a Louisiana industry against a very genuine serious pollution charge while he was at the same time working on a government project to end pollution in the Potomac. Many, many people in this area are extremely double-edged. I mean, double in their thinking and hypocritical. And vested interests are so powerful that one wonders if we can really conquer them. Those are nine pressure points then. These nine pressure points should be appreciated both in isolation and as an aggregate force. But what gives them a compelling cogency is the tenth and final pressure point, the one which is becoming the framework for them all. Now really think through, this is the heart of the question for us, for Christians. This point is the increasing sense of a lack of purpose in our generation. Really think this one through. As George Wall comments, the Harvard biologist, what we're up against is a generation that is by no means sure that it has a future. Some people confidently attribute this symptom to the present vacuum of thought and effective action, but actually the malaise is much deeper than this. It's not just a temporary tiredness resulting from short-term setbacks to the counterculture, but a total failure of purpose, where the current cultural impasse is only confirming the suspicions that we really are facing metaphysical problems in trying to find meaning and purpose in our culture. Incidentally, those who inquire about the source of a sense of future in the Western culture, the sense of future orientation which has been a central hallmark of Western culture, are often surprised that its origins were plainly Christian. If you look back at the Greek or the Eastern thought, or the myths of the pagan nature worship, you can clearly see why they developed no sense of purpose or progress in history, just as those who get into the East today or acid have no great sense of time and purpose. All of these are variations on the cyclical theme of time, and technically they mean that time is proceeding nowhere. By contrast, the Jewish Christian view, with a very strong teleology and a limited linear view of history, gives meaning to man in history and a sense of purpose for the least action or even the relaxation in the middle of action. In other words, all these others just had history as a cycle. Because of this, there was no meaning to the progress of history. Christianity introduced a linear, limited view of history, begun by God, with man acting significantly and wound up by God. And so Western culture has been marked by a strong sense of future orientation. Of course, this has died gradually. But you can see this is really dying out today. What happened was in the Enlightenment, they secularized purpose and made it progress. But now not purpose as man looked forward to God's purposes at the end of history, but progress as man looked forward to his own purposes at the end of history, i.e. man-made utopias, founded not on revelation but on rationalism. Society was seen to progress towards a humanist utopia rather than towards the consummation of God's plans at the end of history. Now, this idea of secular progress was entirely unknown before the 17th century. But it was parasitic. It borrowed from the Christian view of time and nature. And so it didn't last after the erosion of the Christian culture. Today, with philosophy divorced from rationalism, in the present climate, the current situation is ranging itself more and more against optimism, and the whole basis for a future orientation has been undermined, both philosophically and practically. For example, an English philosopher, Brandon, relating the modern loss of a sense of purpose, roots this down into our modern scientific worldview. Put this, philosophy giving no answer, evolution and blind chance giving us no answer. This is how he writes. In this complex of modern science and philosophy, mankind and its affairs are dwarfed to an incidental insignificance, being doomed to extinction when the balance of conditions changes, as it must undoubtedly do in the course of time. This fundamentally impersonal character of the worldview which science authorizes is gradually making its chill logic felt. Yet instinctively, Western man still tends to think with a teleological optimism in terms of the old-fashioned doctrine of progress, which was once inspired by the Christian doctrine that God is working his purposes out. But this will no longer do if God is not there. So he says we must really rediscover some basis for purpose. Philosophy gives us none. Science gives us none. Maybe there's no meaning, no future. Rattray Taylor puts it far more candidly than that. He says, so the need to believe in man's intellectual purpose and in the certainty that it will provide a better life here on earth has become intensified. The optimist cannot give up this belief without abandoning their optimism and relapsing into despair. Moreover, no one likes to live in a chaotic system. In other words, he's saying, I'm optimistic because I have to be, rather than the fact that the evidence is pointing that way. And this predicament is common to many perceptive humanists. If we're realistic in assessing the situation, we're pulled towards an unhealthy pessimism, which cuts the failure of our cuts the nerve of our initiative or our doing anything. But on the other hand, are we to maintain a semblance of confidence, even if its basis is rooted not in evidence, but only in our need to believe? So you have an optimism without a base, or a pessimism which is unwelcome, which pulls you down towards despair. It's in our generation that this despairing logic is most felt. Margaret Mead says that the profound aimlessness is a feature of the younger generation. A Yale professor of psychology, William Keeson, describes our generation as having an odd sense of futurelessness. They never seem to want to talk about their own futures at all. Stephen Spender, the English poet, who spent a year with the radicals in 68, said that to the radicals, future is like a time bomb buried but ticking away in the present. And they're all pointing to the same thing, that our generation has no sense of there being any strong future at all. Now, signs of this are evident in three places. First, in the way we define our utopias. Our generation generally defines its utopias in terms of the past and not the future. For example, most of the intentional communities, the communes and the colonies, they're agrarian, not technological. They're founded on the attempt to return to nature, back to nature, back to wildlife, etc., back to pre-technological conditions. Rarely do you find a member of our generation founding a computer software company and working towards some future scenario. They don't do this. It's always back to something because there's no strong sense of the future. Secondly, you can see this in current radicalism, which is interesting. The SDS president, Todd Gitlin, wrote in a mimeograph, an orientation towards the future has been the hallmark of every revolutionary of the last century and a half. But the new left suffers from a disbelief in the future. He confesses, we find ourselves incapable of formulating the future. If any of you read the founding manifesto of the SDS in Port Huron in 62, it says, our work is guided by the sense that we may be the last generation in the experiment of living. In other words, all the past anarchists, they may have used violence or whatever, but it was only to bring in a new society, and their hopes were geared toward the future. But today we have violence, not as the birth pangs of a new society, but as a terminal frustration like the weatherman, because you can't do anything about the corrupt society, and there's no great sense that tomorrow may bring anything better. Thirdly, you can very strongly see this, and this is just 3 points, expressed in the rock music and poetry of our generation, especially since 1968. In the Isle of Wight Rock Festival, and in the disaster area was left at the end of it, with smoke bombs drifting across the stage, as she was singing, Joan Baez sung her hitchhiker's song for one of the first times. You know the lines in that, it's been issued on record since then. You are the orphans in an age of no tomorrow. And very, very typical of the same sort of mood is the album Chicago 3. You remember the one song, Progress? Was merely their initial music drowned out by the sounds of industrial revolution, with the groaning climax being the whole business being flushed down the toilet. And it ended with a song, Man vs. Man, the End. And you remember the last side of the album had this poem by Kendra Lascelles. When all the laughter dies in sorrow, and the tears have risen to a flood, when all the wars have found a cause in human wisdom and in blood, do you think they'll cry in sadness? Do you think the eye will blink? Do you think they'll curse the madness? Do you even think they'll think? When all the great galactic systems sigh to a frozen halt in space, do you think there'll be some remnant of beauty of the human race? Do you think there'll be a vestige of a sniffle or a cosmic tear? Do you think a greater thinking thing will even give a damn that man was here? And this sort of expression, you can see this all over the place, King Crimson, etc., etc. And you can see the extremeness of this despair probably explains why our generation, when it is so utopian and optimistic, ends up by being incredibly romantic and wistful. Contrast what we've just sung, just read, with, say, the utopian expressions of our generation, like Joni Mitchell's Woodstock, or, say, John Sebastian's I Had a Dream Last Night. And by contrast, although they're very popular, their message is such a far cry from reality that they look extreme, almost the incarnation of wistfulness. In other words, the wheels come full circle. You see these 10 pressure points. The fact that this means at the end that you have this polarization. The optimist is still optimistic, not because of the evidence, because they need to be. Whereas more and more, those who are realistic on the evidence are pulled down towards the verge of a pessimism, let alone a despair, but certainly a sobering pessimism that's extremely realistic. So you see from where we began yesterday afternoon, the wheel has come full circle. Humanism is calling for faith in man against all the evidence of history in the past, and now it's calling for faith in man against all the evidence of man in the future. But the problem is not the future. The problem is man's view of himself as he faces the future. And humanness finds no relief in this embarrassing situation. And a good way to finish this would be a quotation from Arthur Koestler. These could adequately ring down the curtain on the discussion, utopia or oblivion. Koestler concludes his book, The Ghost and the Machine, with these words. Nature has let us down. God seems to have left the receiver off the hook. And time is running out. Which is a nice poetic way of saying very realistically, evolution, in a post-Christian sense, has failed us. The erosion of the Christian culture means we have no God to call to. And we're left, rather than being the center of the stage, pressed with our backs very much to the wall, and time is running out on us. I think it's hardly surprising that if you examine humanism as it is expressed in the adult world, particularly, not only as we looked at yesterday, the crisis of humanism, but this whole thing today, today, they're futurologists, you can understand why a generation that's ours would naturally be hotly disdainful of these empty cultural memories, which is about all that's left of Christianity in our countries, and boldly impatient with these older humanist falterings, and should attempt to build its own alternative. And that's where the counterculture comes in. So it's when you fully appreciate the erosion of the Christian culture, the striptease of humanism, and the dilemmas of the elder humanist looking towards the future, that you see the imperative need for an alternative, the counterculture, the great refusal. And that's what we'll look at tomorrow. But it's intriguing, in this polarization, I'll just be ad-libbing as we finish, we come to this, optimism without a basis, or realism that pulls you towards a pessimism that's sobering, if not despairing, where does Christian fit in this? You see, he must not be caught, and this is just one more, of the extreme polarizations that we have no business of being caught in. But we can escape this polarization simply because our faith is non-humanist. In other words, if you bank your hopes only on man, that's the only two alternatives you have. But Christianity can be both realistic and still be hopeful, because it relies on a faith that's verifiable in history, but has a solution that's non-humanist because it looks forward to God doing something at the end of time. In other words, the Christian has always believed in the purpose in history. You have a God who made history. It's not a cycle. It's a linear, teleological view of history. Man is significant in history. And history is limited, and one day God will step in at the end. But God stepping in is non-humanist. So you don't just end up with a crisis or a humanist utopia, but rather a non-humanist intervention in history. But this isn't just a romantic wish fulfillment in the future, because one's whole faith is founded on the facts that are rooted back in the past and other areas which can be verified. So because of this, the Christian combines the best of that which is realism and that which is still hopeful. So he doesn't look to a humanist situation, and yet he can be realistic about all the problems today. And this means the modern crisis should not cut the nerve of our initiative. Too many Christians are being polarized too. The minute they lose their optimism, they want to take to the hills and get back to the communes. And this is true in all these areas, the future, the city, technology. If they've got no answers, escape to the hills. The point for the Christian will not be all or nothing, optimism or pessimism, but rather the solution is non-humanist anyway. And in the crisis, God calls us to do that which is significant. So we will never achieve the romantic all, nor will we despair at the completely pessimistic nothing. But we're really called to do something which affirms faith in God, which practices the truth of who man is, and affirms the fact that we are the men with a future in our bones because of our non-humanist view of the hope at the end of history. So in this situation where this polarization is going on, looking at the future, we must not be hung up on this. Far too much of the Jesus movement is frightened running to the hills and escaping from the problems. Nor must we be romantic optimists. The problems are there, we must be realistic. But since our solution is non-humanist, we must tackle them, knowing that God's calling us to do our part. That's what Barry was referring to on Sunday when he said in his sermon that I often talk about the communion as a toast to the second coming of Christ. Because if you remember the early Christians taking their cup, they literally took it until he comes. They really looked into the darkness of their times and affirmed their faith in a second coming which would resolve all the pain and the evil and the suffering of all history, let alone their history. And I usually use the great little illustration of the Scottish loyalists at the time of the Jacobin risings. You remember in Scotland at this time, the English were in control of Scotland and the King of Scotland was in France. All over Scotland, this is the 18th century, Bonnie Prince Charlie and all that sort of thing. All over Scotland there was a toast in the Highlands and Islands to the King over the water, and they'd raise their whiskey. Down even in Edinburgh, where the English were in control, they had a very clever thing. They used to take their whiskey, or their water, or whatever it was, and pass it over a glass of water, and just say, "To the King," pass it over the water. The English took it, they were toasting the King of England. They were just toasting a rebel toast to the King in France over the water. In a sense, when the Christian takes communion, he doesn't just look back to the death of Christ. He doesn't just feed by faith in his heart on Christ now. He looks forward to that second coming of Christ over the water of time and toasts until he comes. And that's why the Christian can still be at the same time a realist and yet supremely optimistic because of a non-humanist answer at the end of history. Utopia or oblivion. One more polarization where the Christian way is a third way out of the impasse.